ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Charismatic, rich, stylish, glamorous. Christopher and Pixie Skase were the it couple of the 80s.
Getting an invitation to a Skase party was prized real estate.
But when their business empire teeters, it's Pixie who pays a massive price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman Swan, I think it's no secret that you quite enjoy sharing your ailments, particularly your chronic knee pain.
You drag it out of me.
I don't think I do. I think you're quite quick to volunteer. What are you like with pain?
It just depends. You know, if I stub my toe, I let loose foul expletives in such a loud voice that people think I'm dying. If I'm having a procedure done to me which is uncomfortable, I just grin and bear it. And when something sort of serious happens, like I slice a finger cooking, as I often do,
oh wow,
I'm fairly cool.
Okay. So it depends on the context.
Yeah.
I think that's the same for me. I think if I'm having a particularly horrific day and I'm exhausted, I react quite poorly. But I do think I do a lot of reasoning with myself when things are serious like you do.
Yeah. And, you know, that's acute pain. But chronic pain is a different matter altogether. But it's similarly, your brain does get involved in how you perceive it and your situation.
And there's lots of stuff that needs to be taken into account, your childhood experiences, your history. And I think it's far more complex than what people realise.
That's just part of what's coming up on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Cubby Cubby Land. Also on the show, we're going to follow up on a story that we've been pursuing over the last 2 or 3 weeks, which is about allergies in kids. We keep on getting a lot of mail about it, and there's a lot of confusion amongst parents about how they should introduce allergens to their kids, when and how frequently. So we're going to actually get back to basics and give some simple information.
We're going to simplify things. And you've also got a story, Norman, that connects the nervous system to cancer.
Yeah, nerves supplying the tumour might actually make it grow. And when they've actually got down to it, the chemical messengers are very similar to the chemical messengers, talking about pain, that actually create the pain of migraine. And so it might be that migraine drugs could help treat bowel cancer. Mm-hmm. More of that later.
In the news, August this year is the first month that influenza has been more deadly than COVID-19. So there's been more influenza deaths than COVID deaths for the first time since February 2020.
This comes from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And just to explain, in the light of the COVID pandemic, they are now recording deaths from respiratory infections, three respiratory infections, influenza, COVID, and respiratory syncytial virus. And we've talked a lot about respiratory syncytial virus. There's a vaccine for it now. And they've recorded the deaths from these three viruses over time. And in August, for the first time since the pandemic began, flu has overtaken COVID deaths.
Worth pointing out that it's been a fairly significant flu season with record numbers. So there's been more than 410,000 lab-confirmed cases, and that's likely an underestimation, Norman, given a lot of people are now doing at-home test kits, so not all of them are lab-documented. And very unfortunately, children have been disproportionately affected by the flu season again this year.
They have. And overall this year, COVID deaths still outnumber flu deaths, but only by a little. And the question here is, who's dying? Are there any surprises here? What's happening with respiratory syncytial virus? Because that's kind of a sleeper here, because it is a serious illness, particularly in kids. And influenza, because influenza immunization rates have fallen. So COVID is still in older people. There are younger people dying of it, but basically it's in older people still.
That's right. And when it comes to RSV, the statistics also suggest that the deaths from respiratory syncytial virus or RSV have actually risen compared with the previous 2 years, whereas the COVID deaths have been decreasing. Do you think that COVID is now seasonal? Is that the implication here potentially, that it peaks during the cooler months?
That's what everybody's been waiting for. And when we were doing the CoronaCast podcast, it was a major topic of discussion because there was no seasonality to it. No, flu is a seasonal virus unless it's in pandemic mode. And when you have a pandemic virus, there's no seasonality to it. It just happens all year. And there's just a little bit of a hint that COVID might be becoming seasonal, which would be good news because that means it's moving away from that pandemic feel, if you like, or that pandemic epidemiology. So there's a peak, as there has been right since the beginning, over Christmas, a peak, and another peak over autumn, early winter as well. So it's not necessarily in timing with the cold weather yet. Probably too early to say that it's seasonal, but there is a regular pattern.
And probably a nice time, given we're about to hit the Christmas season, to see if you're eligible for a booster and if you're up to date or not.
And just before we leave these statistics, because the mortality rate from COVID-19 is, according to these data, is 1.5 times higher in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people compared to non-Indigenous people. And in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, you know, First Nations women, the rate of mortality is 2.3 times higher than for non-Indigenous women. And that emphasises the vaccine guidelines, which do suggest that Aboriginal people should be immunised at an earlier age.
Staying in the COVID realm, there's also been some research published in Obstetrics and Gynaecology, which has tried to look at maternal infection with COVID during pregnancy and the potential association with neurodevelopmental diagnoses in children. And this is a study that is retrospective. It's looked at just over 18,000 births in the US, in Boston. And they've looked at mums who've had confirmed COVID infection during pregnancy, so confirmed with a PCR test in the lab.
And this was during the pandemic.
That's right, in the peak of the pandemic, March 2020 to May 2021. And the main outcome they've looked at is the development of a neurodevelopmental diagnosis by the age of 36 months, so 3 years of age. And they found that there is actually a higher risk of neurodevelopmental diagnosis in these children whose mums had an infection during COVID, and the risk was higher if there was exposure in the third trimester and in male offspring.
So I think the main message from here is, I mean, that this is a study looking back. It's been pretty well done. You can say that there is an increased risk. Could be through brain inflammation. It could be all sorts of reasons why this might occur. The bottom line here is, for both flu and COVID-19, pregnant women need to be immunised.
And people might have seen stuff out of the US with RFK Jr. because there have been changes to the vaccine schedule there, and COVID vaccination is no longer recommended for pregnant people, but certainly in Australia it still is. And if you're pregnant, you're at higher risk of COVID complications, so vaccination is still recommended.
So we need to congratulate Professor Lydia Murawska from Queensland University of Technology, who won the Prime Minister's Science Prize this week. There are always people who are worthy of the prize, but particularly Lydia, and in particular since we've just been talking about COVID-19.
So Lydia was awarded in 2021 one of the most influential people in the world by Time magazine, the top 100 influential people. And I recall, Norman, being a GP on the ground at the start of the pandemic when there was huge debate about how COVID was transmitted, and Lydia was integral.
She was, because we had advising the government a group of people who didn't believe in aerosol spread, who were out of date in terms of the science, and they were going back to 1940s science. So they believed you got it off surfaces, you caught it at close quarters, that's why we had 1.5 metres distance between people. But in fact, it was spread through fine aerosol particles. So if you were quite distant from somebody and you were breathing the same air as them over a period of time, you could actually catch COVID-19, which went against all the advice. And Lydia's point for years has been, we care much more about the quality of outside air than indoor air. And we weren't taking precautions, and we still haven't changed much in the way of our indoor air regulations. But Lydia got together 200-odd of the world's experts in this area, and they published an argument saying, you know, showing the evidence that this was aerosol spread. But I heard that one of the advisors to the government called me a miasmatist, which was essentially going back to the Middle Ages, where, in fact, they probably kind of knew that some of these were aerosol spread, and the miasma was the air that came from the ground and spread disease. Well, I was actually pretty proud to be called a miasmatist, along with Lydia.
Well, I have to say, after that letter was published, the very next day, the World Health Organization actually accepted the airborne pathway of infection transmission, which is, you know, that's a significant contribution to management during the pandemic. I think we should also, whilst we're celebrating good news, just call out the fact that this year there was also the Prime Minister's inaugural prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge systems, and it went to Malgana man Michael Ware, who is doing work on sea cucumbers and an Indigenous-led fishery and seagrass restoration, which is just nice. Good news.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National. So let's get back to not my stubbed toe, but pain, which is an enormous issue. I'm sure in your daily practice you see people who are just not getting better from their pain, and it's a problem. And in the United States, that's one of the causes of all these deaths from narcotics used in medicine.
Which is something that we cover in this interview. But chronic pain, I feel like we cover a lot on the show, Norman. We often talk about osteoarthritis pain. Recently, we talked about chronic pelvic pain. And psychological interventions are often mentioned. But we haven't quite explored what psychology for pain looks like. What does it involve? What's the evidence behind it? What's the role of the brain when it comes to pain?
And as soon as you say psychology, people say, oh, you're just saying it's in my head. I'm imagining my pain, which is in fact far from the truth.
It is far from the truth. And perhaps there is a problem with how health professionals communicate it to patients. But I spoke to an expert to find out all of these things. The person I spoke with is Professor Michael Nicholas, who's a clinical psychologist with over 40 years of experience in the field of pain. He's currently at the Pain Management Research Institute at the University of Sydney.
Naturally, people are sensitive to the idea that the brain might have something to do with pain, because in many parts of the world, that's a bit like saying it's all in your head. It's not real. But if you try to think about, well, what is pain? And it's not just what hurts, because what hurts is pain. So that sort of definition goes around in circles. So one way of thinking about pain that has been agreed to by pain scientists around the world is that it's better described as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with, or resembling that associated with, actual or potential tissue damage. Now, the key points in that definition of pain is that it's a sensory and emotional experience. So it's not a thing. You can't x-ray pain. You can x-ray bones and you can see fractures, but you can't find pain on a scan. But everybody knows what it is. And some describe it as a sensation, but it's more than a sensation, because, you know, it can be quite distressing. And that's already areas where you can see how the brain is involved.
You just said before you can't x-ray pain. So people might have normal imaging, normal CT scans, x-rays, but still have really persistent low back pain, chronic pain. What's happening there with the brain when there's nothing seen potentially on the scan, but there's still a really significant impact on someone's quality of life and their sleep?
Well, chronic pain is defined as pain that persists for more than 3 months. And back pain is probably the most common example. Back pain can be quite intrusive and disabling, but lots of people also have back pain who are not disabled, but who continue to work and function and manage, and it's not a major problem. So just having pain itself is not all there is to it. The impact it has on you, it really depends on its significance for you. Is it interfering with your work? Is it stopping you earning a living? Is it interfering in your relationships? Equally, if you're worried that it's a sign of something terrible going on, like it's a sign of cancer or tumour, then you're likely to get anxious and want to seek reassurance that it's okay. A lot of back pain, for example, it doesn't have clear biological findings, but it's still real. It's just as real as pain where you can find biological, you know, physiological changes. The role of the brain here is not passive, just getting signals coming in from the pain site, but it plays an active role in interpreting what we're doing, what we're experiencing. There are associations between what we feel and previous events. There are memories that can be triggered by sensations. So the brain plays this active role.
So it's a lot about context of the person and maybe previous experiences that really can impact how much the pain kind of intrudes on someone's life, or how much it actually impacts their quality of life.
Definitely, yes. Yeah, yes. So in the old days, but this still
You sound like Norman.
Happens. Yeah, it still happens that when people have pain, they expect to find something physically wrong with them and it should show up on a scan. And when it doesn't, then people either themselves worry that they're just imagining it, or they feel that other people, like their doctor, might think that as well. In fact, we now know there's a very poor relationship between tissue damage and the amount of pain you feel. So someone can have a minor or no clear physical changes or damage and feel pain, or they can have a lot of damage and feel very little pain. So two people may have back pain, but it may have a completely different impact on one compared to the other. And this is often because of the context of their pain, as you mentioned, the significance it has for them, the way they're thinking about it, the way they're reacting to it, will influence what they feel. And so if you're trying to intervene in that, you must firstly assess what are those factors contributing to that person's pain, rather than just having an X-ray or a CT scan and saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, you're fine.
So then how does psychology interventions, Michael, how do they work in someone with chronic pain?
Firstly, we've got to, as I was just indicating, try to assess what are these contributors, what is going on here, what are the thought processes, what's the significance of this experience to the person, what do they think is going on, what are their concerns. In other words, we're not trying to make a sort of a psychiatric diagnosis out of this, like saying they're just depressed and this is just a symptom of depression, which pain can be, actually.
It can be, but not always, isn't it? Because I think
I
think sometimes people, if they're referred to a psychologist for chronic pain, either there's not enough communication from the health professional saying, you know, this psychology is really targeted to the brain for pain. And often people might feel dismissed or as if they're being labelled with a mood disorder when they may not feel they have one. So I think it's important to remind everyone that chronic pain can exist in the absence of other diagnoses in the mental health space.
Oh, yes. So that assessment process is the first step, and it's critical because each person is an individual and that we've got to understand their experience rather than just lump them all together and say, well, I've got back pain, so this is the treatment for back pain. I recommend people think about this as a person with back pain. We're not seeing back pain because we can't see it. It's an experience. What we're seeing is a person who's experiencing this and it's causing them enough concern that they've sought help. So that's what we need to understand first. What are their concerns? And then we must address those when we intervene. There's no use giving them just analgesics by themselves. They can have a place, but it's a very small place. Most of them are quite ineffective. If they have any impact, they don't last long. So people have to learn to manage it themselves once it becomes chronic. And to do that, it's got to make sense to them. So that's our first task. Whether you're a psychologist or a GP or a specialist, you need to help the person make sense of what they're experiencing and don't just label them.
Do you think we're good at that, Michael?
No.
Clinicians, yeah. So what needs to change then? Does there need to be more pain education in consulting rooms?
Yes. Not just in consulting rooms. It needs to be for all health professionals. Because all health professionals, whether they're a doctor or a nurse, a physiotherapist, a psychologist, will see people in pain. It's one of the most common reasons people seek help. And yet we are all poorly trained in how to assess pain and how to help people with their pain. And this is why we actually developed these problems like with the opioids, because people were said, if a so-called weak drug like paracetamol wasn't working, they'd say take something stronger, which meant taking opioids. And that's what led to all the problems that we have had. And obviously, the United States is even worse. It comes from a failure of the health professionals to properly assess and understand a person's pain and help them understand what's going on and developing a plan with the person and not seeing them as just a pain complainer, but rather a person with pain that's causing them concern. If they become disillusioned with the health system or with the treatment they're getting, that's obviously when you can start feeling rather helpless or hopeless and get depressed. But it's a result of the way they've been managed. It's not the cause of the problem, but it will have a feedback loop and make the experience even worse.
Even worse, yeah. When it comes to the psychology interventions that have evidence for chronic pain, what does it look like?
Well, firstly, there's no magic bullet. You know, do this and it'll all go away. That's a total failure to understand the problem. The most studied broad treatment group comes under the heading of cognitive behavioral therapies, which means you look at the way people are thinking, why they're reacting, why they're behaving, the way they're interacting with their experience and also with people around them, and work out with the person. You can't do CBT to people, you do it with them, what might be appropriate for them. And that may include relaxation, it may include mindfulness, but often it'll include exercise, because often people stop doing things because of pain. And that leads to secondary deconditioning type effects. And then people can develop like a fear or belief that they can't do things in pain. When what we've found is that belief that you can't do things in pain is one of the most powerful predictors of disability.
So if you believe that pain is a bad thing, if you don't move, then it can actually negatively impact your outcomes.
Yes. And we've shown in numbers of studies in this country and internationally that it's that belief that you can't do things that is more powerful than fear. But you can change that belief by being guided by a physiotherapist or a psychologist or your doctor to gradually start doing the things you've been avoiding because you didn't believe you could do them. Not overdoing things, because that's one of the dangers, is people behave according to their pain. So when their pain is low, they do more. And then when that stirs the pain up, they stop doing things. That's sort of what's called a boom-bust style of behaviour. What we try to do is get people to learn how to pace their activities without aggravating the pain all the time.
So it's about reframing, re-educating, and really taking the whole person into context, their experience of pain and any kind of previous history.
Yes, yes, yes. And discussing those with the patient, do we need to treat each person as an adult and have a discussion with them, because they are the ones who've actually got to manage it. I often say to medical students and specialists training in pain management that we don't manage pain at all. It's the patient who manages pain.
Yeah, you're giving them the tools.
And what we have to do is help them. Yes, we can teach them strategies, give them information, be a sounding board. But it's very important that we avoid simple explanations, as if there's one simple solution. And you see, you just have to Google back pain and you'll see thousands of pages of absolute rubbish. People saying that, you know, they did this and it all went away, but it doesn't actually have to go away. And that's the whole beauty of the psychological aspect, is that if you realize that actually it doesn't have to stop you functioning, you can get back to work, you can live an active and full life despite pain, then pain will be much less of a problem for you. But chasing complete pain relief is a big mistake, because that's what leads you into all these different drugs which don't work in the end.
For people listening, Michael, who might be thinking, you know, I've been struggling with chronic pain, maybe it's chronic pelvic pain, neck pain, back pain, how do you find a psychologist or a clinician who is skilled in this space? What can we tell people to help guide them potentially?
It's a good question.
Can we all come and see you, Michael?
No, I wouldn't recommend that. Well, firstly, I would see my GP. That medical assessment is very important. A lot of people go to a physio, but really you need to see someone you feel confident in, you have some trust in, and start that process. Public hospitals all have a pain clinic these days. There is a waiting list for many, which is a problem. I mean, one of the things we have developed just recently is an online pain education network for health professionals. So I would ask any health professional who's offering to help with my pain what training they've actually had in pain management. And the reality is very few have had that.
I'm just curious, Michael, what's your approach if someone is referred to you with chronic pain who's slightly resistant? Maybe they feel as if they've been dismissed with the referral, or they're being told that the pain is in their head. What is your approach with that patient?
It's quite common, of course, because people say, look, my pain's in my back or my foot, it's not in my head. So as a psychologist myself, I get that sort of comment, and I quite understand that. That's the community norm, to see things are either physical or psychological. But we actually look at these things as being both physical and psychological. And we need, therefore, to understand what's going on in both domains. So what I start with is not trying to justify my existence to the person. But rather, I'd start to say, well, why don't we actually try to clarify what the problems are? And when we do that, we identify that, you know, the pain's stopping them doing things. They're getting frustrated and angry about it. They're finding the treatments they're getting are not really working. Well, I show people how one thing's led to another as their pain has gone on. They can then quite quickly see that it's not all about what's going on in their back. In fact, once it becomes chronic, the origins of pain have probably got very little to do with what you're experiencing now, what the impact is. It's going to be much more to do with your behavior, the way you're thinking about it, the way you're feeling and interacting. Then people start to see, well, actually, there are a lot of psychological aspects that didn't cause the problem, but have become entangled with it.
Yes, entangled.
And the thing is, you can do something about these things. It's, you know, we can talk about what's going on in your nervous system, but most of us have no ability to directly change that. But what we can do is change our behaviour. We can change the way we think.
That was Professor Michael Nicholas, who is a very experienced clinical psychologist in the field of pain.
A really great interview, Priya, and really comprehensive. Michael knows as much, if not more, than a lot of people in Australia. But the sort of service he provides at North Shore Hospital in Sydney, which is multidisciplinary, a lot of people involved, a lot of training involved, is not available easily elsewhere in Australia. I mean, you have excellent pain centres, but they're overwhelmed.
And I think that's important to acknowledge, that if you really get that gold standard of care in chronic pain, which Michael mentions with physiotherapist, psychology, a health professional like a GP, it can be quite costly if you're not in one of those public pain management units, because the wait list is so long, or you might need services more acutely. It can be quite expensive, even with a GP management plan or subsidies from the government.
And we'll have links to some key resources that might help you on our show notes.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. Over the last few weeks, we have covered stories on food allergies in children, and a couple of weeks ago, we covered research out of the US that showed, with updated guidelines and advice to parents to try and get in common allergy-causing foods like peanut into the diet earlier, it reduces the risk of food allergies, and there have been a significant number of cases avoided in the US as a result of the updated guidelines.
And we had Australian data the following week from Professor Mimi Tang showing that we had similar impact here, perhaps at a lower level because it's more dilute. We may be not following the guidelines quite as closely. And then you had an experience in your surgery, just to bring us up to date.
Yes, where I had a patient have a reaction to an allergy starter pack, so something you can buy from the chemist, which is the powder that you use to try and get in these foods as opposed to the whole food. And so Professor Mimi Tang helped clarify some of the confusion and said, ideally, essentially, go for the whole food if you can, and gave people some tips.
And she commented that the starter packs themselves may actually not do the job because of the dose that's in them and how you use them. So, you know, they are questionable themselves. Anyway, we've had an email from Kylie.
And so Kylie has written in and said, thank you so much for the segment on allergen starter packs. We've been exposing our baby to allergens following the suggested process, not with a pack. And you're right that it's a big job once you factor in continued exposure and getting it all done before the baby is one. I'm not surprised not all families in the experimental groups in the studies to which you refer were not able to follow the protocol exactly.
Hence the lower effects in Australia.
Yes. And then Kylie goes on to say, given these difficulties and the reality that we're all going to have to cut some corners, I think all parents trying to do this would be helped by some advice on how to responsibly prioritise within the protocol.
Important. You've been having a look at what the Australian Society of Clinical Immunology and Allergy is recommending. But before we do that, I mean, really the main aim in the first year of life is to head to a point where by 12 months you've moved to cow's milk, but not relying on milk in the diet. Solids are actually the main part of the diet, and it's a version of what you as a family are eating. And by that time, you're getting a reasonable spectrum of foods. But that still doesn't take away from the need to get in early. So what does ASCIA say, the society?
NIP Allergies in the Bub and ASCIA, which you just mentioned, are amazing resources, which we will link in the show notes. But NIP Allergies in the Bub has a bookmark that all my patients get with the foods on them. Pictures of fish, shellfish, tree nuts, peanut, cow's milk, egg, all of it. What I did, Norman, because I agree with Kylie, it can feel like quite a daunting process. You're exhausted.
And you get enough to think about anyway. I mean, just bringing up a child.
I put it on the fridge and I say to patients, put this on the fridge and ideally do one at a time, as Mimi said last week, so you know if there's a reaction, which food it is to. Once you've introduced it and there's no reaction, you want to reliably keep it in the diet. And the recommendation is for 2 times a week, but you try your best. And as you say, you try and incorporate it into the everyday foods. And canned tuna saved my life because it's fish and I love canned tuna. So my kids are not allergic to fish, thank goodness. But I think it's important that people go and look at these resources. And as Kia also do say on their website, that the packaged foods for babies that contain most of the common allergy-causing foods are now widely commercially available, and that's what we spoke about last week. And they actually do say, whilst they appear to be convenient for introducing the common allergy-causing foods, it's important to remember that there are many benefits to feeding babies, the actual food rather than powdered options. And they recommend the whole food.
So have you got any practical tips?
So, do one at a time. Try and introduce it in the family meal. If you can put prawns into a fried rice once you've got shellfish in, however you do it, just break the rules with recipes and get those allergy foods in. And with nuts, once you've got them in, blitz them. So peanut, walnut, hazelnut, put sesame seeds in there once it's all introduced and just pop it onto oats or whatever breakfast is happening in the morning and just keep it in the diet.
So stay cool. The world is not a perfect place. Just do what you can.
Yes. We're not nailing it either. Just so you know, I didn't nail it either, but I had a crack.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. Now I want to talk about some really fascinating research from Melbourne, which looks at the influence of the nervous system on cancer. It's not something you think about. You think about hormones, maybe. You think about messaging inside the cancer, which allows it to spread. The last thing you think about is the nervous system. But there actually are data which suggest that the nervous system can play a role in cancer. And we had a story not so long ago, you might remember, about stress and breast cancer and using beta blockers, which might actually help women with hard-to-treat cancer. It's still to be absolutely conclusively proven, but it also shows that the nervous system can get involved here. And the nervous system is chemical as well. So you have these neurotransmitters that transmit information or take information into the nerves back to the system. That's what we were talking about with pain. So really interesting research, which looks at these chemical transmitters in nerves and their influence on tumours. And work at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute has found that there's a neurotransmitter that seems to stimulate cancer growth. And it's a similar neurotransmitter to the one that seems to be involved in migraine, or you would say migraine.
Migraine.
You say tomato, I say tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. But anyway, let's go back to the story. The possibility here is that some newer migraine drugs might actually, you've infected me, I'm now saying migraine. Newer migraine drugs might actually be useful in treating colon cancer. So it's too early yet to say that. But here to talk about her research is Dr. Pavitha Parathan, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute.
Scientists initially thought that nerves were just used as sort of like a passage that cancer cells can travel on to reach the cancer itself. But now, based on a few other studies, we know that nerves sort of supply and enrich cancer cells and promote their growth.
To what purpose?
We have found in our study that sensory nerves are looking out for sort of noxious or harmful stimuli. So we found that one specific type of these sensory nerves, which secrete a neuropeptide called CGRP. Now, neuropeptides are signaling molecules that are secreted by nerves to sort of communicate not only with each other, but effector cells as well.
By effector cells, these are the cells on which the nervous system is giving messages to do something.
Correct. And we have found that in colon cancer or bowel cancer, CGRP actually promotes the growth of these tumours.
Inadvertently, they're making the tumour worse.
Absolutely. So that really kind of shows you how cancer really changes everything. Cancer cells actually hijack these nerves and they fuel their own growth. But what our paper has actually found that other than these sensory nerves actually producing this neuropeptide, we've actually found that these bowel cancer cells are actually making this neuropeptide as well. So we actually have two sources causing the growth of these cancers.
And you found it in stomach cancer as well.
Yes, we did this in both bowel and gastric cancer, and we found the same pattern.
There is a link here with this growth in numbers of young people developing colon cancer.
Yes.
And this is linked to this neuropeptide that you're talking about in some of these people?
It could be, but our research hasn't looked into that portion yet.
So in your paper, you're talking about RAMP1?
Yeah, so RAMP1 actually is the, you can say, the functional co-receptor for the ligand, so CGRP. So CGRP will bind to a receptor complex that is made up by RAMP1, which is the functional co-receptor. So in our study, we used a technique called CRISPR, which is a gene editing technique. And what we did was we deleted RAMP1 in our colorectal cancer cells.
So this is the lock into which the key fits, in a sense.
Exactly.
So you got rid of the lock, so the key had nowhere to go.
Exactly. And once the key had nowhere to go, tumors were decreased.
And the lock seemed to be increased in younger people with cancer. Not everybody, but at a higher rate.
We didn't find that in the colorectal cancer cohort, but we did find that in our gastric cancer cohort that there was a greater number of RAMP1 positive tumor cells in people below the age of 55.
Just before we get to treatment, so these are called nociceptor cells. These are cells that if you've got a painful stimulus, these transmit the painful stimulus to the brain, so you feel pain. Now, some intestinal cancers are notorious for pain. Pancreatic cancer is one of them. Is there any evidence that these nociceptor cells are involved in cancer pain as well, and that there's a link between cancer pain and cancer growth through the nervous system?
That's actually an excellent question. You would definitely hypothesize that that would be a major source, but I'm a bit unclear at the moment at what the research is pointing to.
So in summary, you found that the nervous system is involved, a chemical messenger from the nerves is involved, and sometimes the tumors produce that themselves. This is opening up theories for how treatment might work. Now, some people have suggested that you could actually cut the nerves to that particular part of the bowel or the stomach, and that's going to solve the problem. Have people tried that?
Yeah, so about a decade ago, a group published a very elegant study, did this with gastric cancer. So here, they actually chemically and surgically cut off the vagus nerve. And yes, it was successful in reducing the growth of tumors, but you do have a lot of side effects. They also found that the tumors could regrow again. So better treatment option would be targeting this directly without having to do that.
So what are the drugs that could be used to block this chemical messenger?
Yeah, so this lock and key, as you said, with CGRP binding to RAMP1, so this is the mechanism that is the target of migraine therapy. These drugs will either block the lock, which is CGRP, or the key, RAMP1, and these are already clinically available. So our next phase in our research is really going to be seeing how we can repurpose these drugs for cancer therapy.
Why wouldn't you just give them the way they are?
In cancer, the expression is a lot different. There are a range of these drugs available. Currently, I'm working on trialing which one is going to be the most suited for cancer therapy. And we are getting hints that some drugs may work better than others. We know that there are sort of maximum dosages already that patients can be tolerated with. I guess the real important question here is that we also hypothesize that, you know, the key, which is RAMP1, is also expressed on immune cells. So whether it can synergize with current immunotherapies and how well it can be done is one of the questions that we do have to ask before we can run it into clinical trials. As long as people don't get the idea that, yes, you know, if they have cancer, they can just go and buy these and take them. We don't know. And there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done on dosages, delivery as well, so they could be sort of more targeted to the cancer cells rather than affecting the brain where they're traditionally meant to act on. So that's what the next phases of our research is really going to focus on.
We had a story a couple of months ago on the use of beta blockers, drugs that are traditionally used to control blood pressure, but also stress responses in difficult to treat breast cancer, so-called triple negative, where stress may actually make these tumors worse and that blocking the stress may actually affect the tumor growth. But beta blockers block neurotransmitters. Are beta blockers part of the story?
Beta blockers are not part of this story, but you're absolutely right. So in those cases, they actually used beta blockers in tandem with immunotherapy as well. And they found that they synergized quite nicely together, which helped improve overall patient survival. So even though beta blockers aren't involved in this story, it is, I guess, a really good example at how targeting both nerves into current approaches in cancer actually can be very beneficial.
Pavitha, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me and for these great questions.
Dr. Pratheetha Parathan is a postdoctoral researcher at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute in Melbourne.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So what's in the mailbag?
So we've had Alison write in response to the pulse oximeter story that you did last week, suggesting that they're not quite as effective at measuring oxygen levels in people who are darker skinned.
And just to explain, what we're talking about here is that, if you didn't hear the story, it's that little thing that they put on your, the little sleeve that they put on your index finger when you go into the casualty department or maybe after an operation to measure your blood oxygen level.
And Alison writes, thank you for the program today. It would be good for Dr. Swan and Dr. Alexander to highlight the absence of information in most Australian first aid courses, certainly in nearly everyone that I have done in the past 30 years, about how people of colour present with shock and low oxygenation differently.
And we should just talk about the word shock. So word shock medically means different from either an electric shock or getting a fright. Shock is loss of blood, loss of blood pressure, and is, you know, a life-threatening condition.
Very unwell. And so Alison writes, first aid content always talks about the person looking pale, red in the face, blue, grey, etc. But these descriptors are based on difference from how Caucasian people usually appear, not necessarily applicable or best advice if trying to assess a patient who has black or brown skin, and I completely agree. And can I just say, Norman, I've only ever had one instructor explicitly mention that.
So how does it present in people of colour?
Well, they might not have the colour changes that you might expect in a Caucasian person. So I don't necessarily go blue or red. I might lose a bit of my skin tone colour, but it might not be visible enough for you to recognise.
So in you, it's got to go by your pulse and your blood pressure.
Please put the cuff on my arm. Please actually feel my radial pulse. I would be eternally grateful.
And before I get failed on the definition of shock, it's not just blood loss. It could be infection.
Septic
it could be a
shock,
heart attack.
Yes. I wasn't going to pick on you, but I just assumed that you knew that.
I wouldn't assume anything. You know,
no, I don't assume anything.
I trained before the antibiotic era.
David has also written in saying, I'm writing to thank you for your coverage of osteoarthritis. I feel this is an email directly to you, Norman.
An email.
Because you do love the osteoarthritis chats. But to let you know the significant impact it has had on my quality of life. At around 10 years of age, I was struck by a truck while riding my bicycle. My left knee was severely injured. After a long course of physio, I recovered, or so I thought.
He basically developed early arthritis. A very, very similar story to mine, I must say. He was diagnosed at an early age with osteoarthritis and, you know, advised that, you know, he was heading towards surgery and so on. And then in 2017, he heard an interview I did with Professor David Hunter at the University of Sydney, which talked about regenerative and degenerative factors and rehabilitation, which is what he did. And at 51, he's back to running.
Wow. David actually says, none of this would have happened without you, the Health Report crew and Professor David Hunter.
Isn't that nice?
And he says, ballet has replaced gymnastics and I'm due to make my first performance at the end of the year. We would love to come if you tell us, David. Norman and I might be in the audience cheering you on, but we do love your emails. If you'd like to write into us, it's healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, Watch That Rash, where this week we're comparing dry needling with acupuncture and do they work to treat pain.
I'll see you next week.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.